Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 29 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my hostess, the great, the outdoorsy, Erin Paulette. How are you doing, Erin?
Oh, are we starting now? See, I actually wasn't sure because, well, last week you said that you were going to do the mag dump the week after, but somehow the week after turned into the Friday when I'm driving down to Miami. So if what you say isn't what you mean, then I honestly didn't know if we were actually starting the podcast now.
I am so sorry for that, Erin. Yes, we have just recently recorded a mag dump, and I asked people when would be a good time, and Erin said, not this week, too busy, next week. And I said, okay. And then somewhere along the lines, my brains got entirely scrambled, and I did it that Friday. And in the best I could do in my own defense is, have you ever bumped into somebody and went, oh, how you doing, man? What's going on? How you been? And all that. He goes, no, just like I was telling you last week. And you're like, last week? It was the last time I saw you last week. It feels like it's been like a month and a half since I've seen you. I've been running around so much that it literally felt like it had already, a week had already passed, and it was just 3 days. Sorry, Erin.
So I'm going to apologize on your behalf to our listeners for the sadly Erin-less mag dump that you're going to get.
Yes, they will. They will. They will feel the horrible pain, and it will be all my fault.
All right. I've punished you enough.
The beatings will continue until morale improves.
Until my morale improves.
I just heard you take a sip of your rum. I think the beatings have no part in this whatsoever.
So, it has been a very busy week because I drove down to Miami for the Line in the Sand gathering at South Point Pier in Miami Beach. And it was very interesting. I don't really know where to begin. I could begin with the drive.
Let's talk about the drive because especially, you know, people like me from New England, or just generally, as a general rule, I just hear people say, oh man, yeah, you're from Maine. This other person's from Maine. Yeah, that's like a 6-hour drive between like the southern part of Maine and the northern part of Maine. Like there's a lot of people don't realize, they think, oh, you're from that state. Do you know this person? Yes, I know everybody in my state. People don't realize, myself included, when I drove from Fort Myers to Tampa thinking that was close. that's not too far away. Yeah, when you drive from the northern part of Florida to the southern part of Florida, how long did that take you?
Here's the thing. I'm not even northern Florida. I'm central Florida.
Okay.
I am roughly, well, I'm a little bit north of Orlando. Orlando is practically smack dab in the middle of the state. And so to the west of Orlando and a little bit up is Tampa Bay. And then to the east of Orlando and a little bit up is Daytona Beach. Mm-hmm. And so I'm about halfway down. It'll take me about, actually, I'm not even halfway down because I can make it to the Georgia line in about 2 hours or so given traffic. So I left home at 1 o'clock. And 4 hours later, I hit Miami. Now, hitting Miami doesn't mean I got to my hotel. See, at 5 o'clock, I hit Miami rush hour traffic. And for the next 2 hours, I dealt with rush hour. As if there's only one, it's so cute. Now, I've driven in bad traffic, and this isn't the worst traffic I've ever seen, because I lived for 5 years in the Washington, D.C. area, where the Washington Beltway is just a parking lot that moves at about 35 to 40 miles an hour. I've driven through Atlanta, the worst traffic by far I've seen, where everyone drives at about 80 miles an hour. There's a foot of distance between bumpers, and I white-knuckle going, all it's going to take is for someone to tap their brakes and we all die in a pileup. Miami traffic isn't bad. It's just big and long. And it really wasn't helped by the fact that they seemed to be doing construction and they had multiple lanes missing. So it literally took me an additional 2 hours from the beginning of the Metro Dade area to get to my hotel.
Ugh.
And if you ever go to Miami, my advice, and I'm going to qualify this in a moment, but my advice is do not actually stay on the beach. I picked a hotel that was very close to where we were having the gathering, thinking I wanted to get there quickly, didn't want to deal with traffic. So I picked one that was only a couple blocks away, and it wasn't terribly expensive. It was about $100 a night. But here's the thing. Miami nightlife, especially on the weekend, parking is horrendous. I checked into the hotel and the clerk asked me where I wanted to park. He asked me where I had parked. And I said, I just parked on the street. He said, did you pay? And I said, I didn't know I had to pay. I didn't see any parking meters. And apparently the city of Miami has paired with a company called PayMobile, where you use your smartphone app to pay for a set number of hours on the street. And on the street, it's $4 an hour.
Ugh.
Yes. And I thought that was ridiculous, and so I asked the clerk what my other options were. He said, well, you can have the hotel valet park your car for $35 a night. Back. Or you can just leave it on the street and be ticketed. And that ticket is $18. And I had to stop him, and I said, now, wait a minute. I want to make sure I understand you correctly. You are actually telling me that breaking the law is the cheapest option here. He said yes.
Oh, goodness gracious. I had no idea that Miami was an Eastern Bloc country.
It seems to have combined the elements of a corrupt Caribbean nation with the forward thinking of the United States. Because, so here's the thing. I mean, I was thinking, okay, well, maybe you have to go to traffic court to pay it. And all right, so you don't want to park on the street because, you know, you'll lose a day going to court. He says, no, you just pay online.
Yep.
And I said, now, you do this? He says, oh, yeah, absolutely. Because they don't always get me. And so if I park and they don't get me, that's a bonus. And if they get me, well, then, you know, I just pay for it out of my salary. It's cheaper. And I was just aghast at this, how it's almost an automated bribe system. Yeah, I'll just break the law. There you go.
Well, when you think about the parking on the street app, which, by the way, can we stop with the, I drove into Boston and parked at a train station and rode in there, and I needed an app to park in that train station. Because they'd gotten rid of their paying attendant. And so I couldn't just throw a couple bucks at the person and pull into the lot. Why do I need 500 apps to pay for the various things that I want to pay for? Oh my goodness. When you get that app and you're paying, the people who run that app, they're getting their beaks wet and then they're probably giving some stuff to the city. When you get a ticket on your windshield, the city gets all that money.
Yeah.
So, yeah, why would they not encourage that?
So, I just thought it was weird that the cheapest option is just to break the law, and people do it on a regular basis. And the other thing is that because Miami, specifically the beachfront, is such a it's such a tourist attraction. It is thriving. I drove around for like, well, it felt like an hour. It probably wasn't. But on Saturday night, trying to find a parking space within walking distance of my hotel, and it took me forever to find one. So if you go to Miami, first of all, I recommend don't stay at a hotel near the beach. If you do, don't take a car. Just take Uber, take a taxi, take whatever. You will not find a parking spot. Now, Weird, you, I think, would love the beachfront. I couldn't stand it because I am very introverted, and I don't like really loud music. And I'm going down the street because I'm looking for a place to have dinner. And they've got these outdoor cafes. Well, actually, they're restaurants as well. They're indoors, but, you know, it's Florida. They're going to have the patio space open for as long as they can. And every place has got the very hot salsa music going, and it's pumping. And you've got the limos going by with the lights, and they're doing their music. And I saw a guy rollerblading down the middle of the street. He was basically skating down the dotted line, you know, bare-chested and putting on a show. And it was very vibrant, and I hated every minute of it because I don't like a lot of noise. It's like, look, I just want to be in a place where I can eat my dinner quietly. You don't inflict your music on me. I can select what music to listen to, or I can read a book. I just want to have a little quiet time to have my dinner and settle down and go to sleep. You, on the other hand, I think would absolutely love this place because it's thriving and bustling, and there's all these people moving past, and, you know, if you like to people watch, it's great. Beautiful women out there in all sorts of very short dresses or other tight clothing. It's a tropical atmosphere. You know, people are going to get away with wearing as little as they can. So if you're into that sort of thing, you will have a blast, and you would enjoy it. Just don't stay on the beach.
Oh, that sounds hilarious. And you sound very much on like the look that my wife gives me when I'm in the kitchen cooking and I've decided I'm cooking. What do I cook to? Psychobilly. And occasionally I'll walk into the living room. My wife is attempting to read a book and scream the lyrics at her. She must like me for some reason. I don't know. I have yet to figure it out. And by the way, I'm looking at a map of Florida right now, and I had always just in quick looking at maps of Florida seen Daytona Beach being like the next thing down from Jacksonville, which is pretty much right on the Georgia line. And I realized, oh, nope, that's the exact same thing as the, like, I'm in Fort Myers. Rob Allen is having a blogger get together in Tampa. Oh, yeah, I can make that drive. They're right next to each other. 2 hours later.
So
let's get down to brass tacks here. How was the event, and how was the fishing?
Well, I didn't fish, and that was a deliberate choice of mine. I also didn't open carry for about the same reason, because, as we mentioned last week, Florida law says you can open carry if you're engaged in fishing. And I've got the license. I didn't want to deal with the extra weight of dealing with fishing. I'm not very good at fishing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to open carry because I didn't want to deal with the whole, yes, hello, officer. Yes, here's my license. Yes, the name on the fishing license and the name on my driver's license doesn't match the person in front of you. Yes, I'm trans. Yes, are we going to have a problem here? Do I need to take off my wig? Do I need to talk to you in butch voice? Are you going to take me down to the station? I didn't want to deal with that. And I think this was a good choice because when I got down there, they were actually carding people, for lack of a better term. Someone would get out and they were open carrying, and the police would come over and immediately check their fishing license. Mm-hmm. Now, the plan was we were going to meet at a parking garage, and we would march over to the Miami Beach Police Department, do a Pledge of Allegiance, walk a mile to the pier, and then do our fishing. And that got changed at not exactly the last moment, but it was late on Friday. And what instead happened was we would meet at the entrance to the park, because the pier and the beach are all part of a park that exists at basically the end tip of Miami. And so in order to get there, well, you can walk in for free, but if you're driving, you have to park in the parking lot, and they charge you like $20 to get in. Every price there is just outrageous. And so the change was, we were going to meet in the parking lot at the entrance to the park, and then we would walk through the park and onto the pier. And there was a very big police presence there. It wasn't that there was a cop every few feet, but you could always find one in your field of view. And I think when we marched in, there were at least a dozen of them.
They knew about this. This was, I know it was not a permitted event, but you also were not shy about the fact that, no, we're holding this. And we're holding this because of this event that you did that was clearly breaking the law. We might discuss, there might be a discussion in the court about the letter of the law, but in the spirit of the law, oh, no, you guys definitely goofed on that. And I could see there's only two reasonable responses for such of that. One is completely ignore you guys and be like, yep, nope, never heard of them. Never heard of a Florida carry. And then there's people open carrying on the pier. Really? Never heard of them. Or show up and card every last person in hopes that you're going to get some Cletus that's going to be like, I know my rights, and not be following the rules to a T and making sure everything's all squared away.
The impression I had was that the police were there because the city council was convinced we were going to scare everyone. The attitude of the police, for the most part, other than the ones who were right there when people got out of their cars, they just looked bored and hot.
That's because beat cops are not the same as brass.
Yeah. And so they knew we were coming because the lead counsel for Florida Carry, Eric Friday, who we had on the show, he told them. He made sure they knew. I have seen letters where someone from the city council told the police, you know, hey, this is going to happen. So they knew full and well what we were doing. They knew full and well that it was legal. And the entire point of this was, back in July, when the South Point Six were arrested, they were just open carrying pistols, and they were detained at gunpoint for over 2 hours. So if the Miami Beach police are going to detain people for that, well, then we're going to show up with long guns, and we're going to kind of tweak their noses. Now, again, the march was going to be an added tweak, and it got changed, and I don't really know why it got changed. A lot of people were very upset about that. They really wanted to march. I've got some theories, and I don't know how true any of them are. One of the things I heard was that the older members of Florida Carry did not want to walk for a mile in the heat.
That's understandable.
And I can't blame them. Yeah, that's pretty valid, especially given how hot it was that day. Another thing I heard is that there were going to be members from the Gillum campaign. Gillum is the Democrat candidate for governor, and he's running on a ridiculously anti-gun platform. He's talking about, the NRA sued me and I won, and I won't get into that, but he's pitching himself as the scrappy underdog versus the evil gun lobby. And we had been told that there were going to be members of the campaign there to photograph us and try and, I don't know, provoke us or see if they could catch us in the slip up or otherwise use us as ammunition against the pro-gun candidate DeSantis. And so maybe that was a reason why we cut the walk short, to give them fewer chances to catch us.
Could it also be the idea of people, because the plan would be to open carry for the march, right?
Oh, yeah.
So to show up at a place that you can't fish at, I assume that there's no legal fishing at the police station.
No, but the law states that you can open carry while you are going to fish, mm-hmm. engaged in fishing, and coming back from fishing.
Yeah. So I wonder on the, say, you know, saying the Pledge of Allegiance, technically, I mean, again, this is all, you know, BS, period. You should be able to open carry all the time. It doesn't matter. Number one, open carry. It's perfectly fine. It's perfectly cool. I'm not an anti-open carry person. Two, if my coat gets caught in the wind and someone sees the butt of my gun, I shouldn't go to jail for that. So either way, you know, I'm not being, you know, a devil's advocate against open carry. I'm just going, when you're dealing with goofy laws that you're working your way around, because Florida open carry is illegal. And then there is this neat little niche carved out where, yes, you can open carry here. Very similar to the Texas thing of the, oh, these people are showing up to Starbucks with their AR-15s. Yes, because Texas says you can't open carry a handgun, but you can't open carry a long gun. So they got to bring their ARs.
Mm-hmm. So for whatever reason, we didn't do the mile-long walk. People grumbled. But considering some of the gear people were carrying, I mean, full-size rifles and their fishing rod and all their lures, and people were toting along coolers full of ice and water, and you know, water is heavy, right? There were a lot of people who actually had to stop and rest during the, I don't know, couple hundred yards walk from the beginning of the parking lot to the pier where we were going to fish. So yeah, I think it was a good choice in hindsight. I still don't understand the reasoning, but it was probably a good idea. And when we got to the pier, a wonderful thing happened. There was another uniformed officer there, and he had a bag of lollipops. It looked like a gallon-sized bag of candy. And he had it, and he was holding it on an outstretched arm. I mean, he was clearly offering it. He was shaking it. And he was saying to people when they showed up, hey, do you have a reel for me? Do you have a fishing rod for me? And he's offering the candy. Now, I thought this was brilliant, because if he had come out and said, hey, guys, I think you're cool. I don't have a problem with you being here. I'm just here because I was told to be here. I'm not going to hassle you. That might get him in trouble with a superior later on, because, as you said, the brass are not patrol. And if someone heard that, he could get a new one chewed, because why are you telling these people that you're okay with them? You might have to arrest them. We want them scared and on their best behavior. Rawr, 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 rawr. And so he's just friendly. He's asking us if he can fish with us. He's offering us candy. He demonstrates that he's cool with us without having to actually say anything that could get him in trouble. And I thought that was brilliant. And that really set the tone for the entire time we were out there. We were out there for 4 hours and some change. And fully 90% of the people that I saw did not seem to care. Really, it comes down to, I think that there were two people I saw who didn't like what we were doing. And one of them was very surreptitiously running around taking pictures of all of us as if we could somehow be shamed or blackmailed for open carrying. I don't know. One guy took a picture of us as we were marching back and said something like, I don't approve of open carry. And it's like, okay, whatever. Go do your thing. We did have one. Well, there was one reporter that I know of that showed up that wanted to talk to us. And the regular members of Florida Carry had been told, don't talk to the media because they're going to try and trip you up. Just bring them over to one of the members of the board of directors. And so when someone from the local CBS affiliate wanted to do an interview, I brought him over to Eric Friday because, hey, I know him. He's a lawyer. He can talk to the press. The only other thing that I saw was interesting was someone walked past, and he was obviously a tourist from a foreign country. He spoke good English, but he had an accent, and he wanted to know why we needed rifles while we were fishing, because it really came down to, you are not going to shoot the fish. Why do you need the guns? And it turns out he was from Ukraine, and he was just very curious. He didn't seem offended. It was just, I do not understand your country. And we explained it to him, and he went, oh, okay, I understand. Very good. And he went about his way. And really, 90% of the people did not care. I mean, I saw parents with small children, like 4, 5, 6 years old, walking past us. And if you thought we were dangerous, you would not walk your young child anywhere near us. So people just didn't care. It was just this tiny fraction of people who are, unfortunately, the loudest mouthed that had a problem with us. And so I was out there. I had a great time. Really, the one disappointing thing is that I didn't see a single member of Pink Pistols come out.
Oh, that's too bad.
And that was, That was really disappointing to me because we have a Fort Lauderdale chapter. Fort Lauderdale is in the area. And none of them came by, and so that was disappointing. But I was there repping Pink Pistols and Operation Blazing Sword. I wasn't the only queer person there. I was the only trans person there. But I wasn't the only queer person there. I was there with my rally wife, Lucy. I don't know if I told you this. I mentioned this when I was at the rally in Tally. I met this other queer woman who was just so thrilled that I was up there speaking, and we got along really well. And we hit it off so much that I just decided that she was going to be my rally wife. And she thought that was hilarious. And so that's how I talk to her now. And so she was there, and she was actually wearing an Operation Blazing Sword t-shirt.
Oh, I saw those pictures.
Yes. Yes. She is the Latina in the green t-shirt. And so she was wearing the Twitter logo with the camo and rainbow stick figures. And I had a really cute pink polo with a very nicely embroidered Operation Blazing Sword logo. Don't ask me how much it cost. And so I was there, and I was repping both the organizations and, of course, the quote-unquote queers with guns. Oh, one last thing. I actually met four members of the South Point Six. Really nice people.
Well, that's awesome.
Really, nothing more to add there. Just I met them. They're mm-hmm. cool. They're absolutely not the crazy types that the media makes you think they are, but of course you knew that. And what I thought was interesting, but you will not be surprised by this, is that when people were talking about the open carry fishing before it happened, there was the typical pearl clutching. Oh my God, these armed people. Oh, you may not want to bring your children. Oh, it's going to be horrible. But after it happened, when literally nothing newsworthy happened other than people with some guns were there fishing and they all followed the law and nothing happened. There is one article about us, and it was, I think, put out by the Associated Press, because I've seen it reprinted verbatim across several different news outlets. Like the one in West Palm Beach is identical to the one in Tampa, and they use the same dang video. They just used a different video format. I'm actually there in some of the video for about 6 seconds as I walked past.
And you looked lovely, by the way. I've only seen you in very fancy dresses. I referred to them in gowns when I was talking to you before the show, and you're like, you have not seen me in a gown. I'm like, Aaron, the longest part of me packing for Chicago was finding my polo shirts and nice slacks, because you told me I should wear a polo shirt and nice slacks. And I'm like, I know I have them. Where are they?
And that was good advice, wasn't it?
It was great advice.
Good.
I don't know. I have no fashion sense whatsoever. I would have been perfectly comfortable in like shorts and a t-shirt and a Budweiser koozie.
Well, okay. But yeah, you've basically seen me in what I would consider to be business dress.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really have anything that was suitable for outdoorsy stuff, and I had to put it together. And I was worried, but everyone said I looked great. And what was it you said about me?
Oh, yeah. Mama was going to go hook us some amberjacks. by the way, were there any amberjacks hooked? They're tasty.
I don't know. I know that there were some fish caught, not many. Mm-hmm. There was a big one. It was about 2 feet long or something.
Nice.
I think it was actually one of the South Pointers, the South Point Six, that got it. Michael, somebody or other. I'm horrible with names. But there were a few fish caught, but not a whole lot. But we were there mostly to have fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And make a point, and we did. And I got a little bit crispy. I got a little bit sunburned on my arms.
Ugh.
Yeah. The sunscreen must have sweated it off. So yeah, I mean, this big deal was made, and of course, you know, everyone behaved, no one got in trouble, no one got arrested, and like I posted on my blog, and you know, folks, if you want to watch the video, if you want to, there was one guy out there who was live streaming. He live streamed like 3 hours of it. If you want to see that, there's a link to my blog in the show notes. Go follow that. But I actually posted a still from the camera thing of me walking past, you know, where it shows my butt. And I actually captioned it with, "Does this freedom make my butt look big?"
And like everybody on Facebook, I'm not going to answer that. There's no safe, when a female asks you that question, there's no safe ways to answer. you know, fake a seizure, fake a heart attack, you know, you know, pick up your phone and immediately take an emergency phone call. Does not matter what the butt is, does not matter who it's attached to. No, it's a trap.
No, honey, traps are different from trans. And I'm just going to leave that hanging. That is an exercise for the apt listener.
So, Aaron, you mentioned the fact that a whole bunch of Floridians with rifles showed up and nobody cared, including the press. That leads me to something that I wanted to talk about, which is gun control is such a hot button issue. It is such the ticket for the midterm election that the gun control groups aren't talking about gun control. Have you been following any of this?
Somewhat. It's more a case of I have noticed the sudden absence of gun control talking points. And now we're talking about other things like immigration or the economy or how awful Trump is or things like that. And yeah, gun control has just suddenly not been an issue. So what's going on with that? Is there some sort of overall plan here?
Well, so the big thing is that you've got there's two big stories that I've seen. One is the I got to look to see where it came from. Is that the Washington Times? I've got linked in the show notes, is pointing out the fact that like every town is actually financing abortion ads and other things like that. Is they're pushing their candidates, but they're pushing them with other stuff on their platform, not their gun control business. And on the other side, also actually just today at the time we're recording this on Monday, at the time of this, every town just released a new ad on YouTube, and it at the end has a long just crawl where it's there's no vocals in it whatsoever, where it talks about gun violence statistics, but you have to sit through, it's like a 4-minute ad. I was thinking 4 minutes, that's the perfect size for a Weird Audio Fisk. I'm in. There isn't a single word in the entire spoken word in the entire thing, and it's just got some text at the end that is gun control propaganda. It's very, very soft and subtle.
The word perfunctory comes to mind.
Yeah, that's a good word. It's a really good word. Also, there's a Project Veritas. Our friend James O'Keefe, he has targeted Claire McCaskill.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah, she's not talking at all about the fact that she is a super banny gun banner, turn them all in type person. And he's gotten her and staffers on hidden camera talking about the fact that, oh, yeah, no, we're super duper anti-gun. We're just not going to talk about it. We're just keeping it quiet until after the midterm elections. Like, just direct, like, not even the, oh, no, that's just not the issue that we're talking about right now. No, it is the, no, ixnay on the uncontrolled gay. Which is actually pretty hilarious in pig Latin, come to think of it. But gun control, it's so hot button that they are doing, they're directly working hard. They're burning calories so as not to talk about gun control. I wonder why.
I don't know why either, especially since, 90% of Americans are supposed to be in favor of it?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we've been told?
That is absolutely what we've been told. And who are you going to believe? Michael Bloomberg or your lying eyes? So we talked a bunch about the Bloomberg stuff. And all right, look, I'll go through. A lot of these folks are Democrats. But again, as you heard last week, not all Democrats are anti-gun, and as I mentioned last week, not all Republicans are our friends on gun rights. That was with us talking to Lara Smith of the Liberal Gun Club, and it was. I hope you all enjoyed that interview. I thought it was an absolutely great one. But that leads a question: what is the Liberal Gun Club? I'll let Lara explain it herself. So with me again is Lara Smith. She is the national spokesperson for the Liberal Gun Club. And I think we talked a lot about diversity in the last interview. I think it's kind of important to talk about what is the Liberal Gun Club.
Well, thank you for having me on again. So we are a national organization, and we represent everybody left of center who also supports the Second Amendment. And even left of center to us is we have everything in our membership from libertarian to anarcho-communists. And we really are a big tent. You know, we're not the Democratic Gun Club for a reason. We're the Liberal Gun Club. And we do have a big segment of our population that identifies as more liberal that are gun owners. And what we say is we want every single civil right for every single person.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, I myself identify as classically liberal in the sense of, yes, I value all of my civil rights and I value everybody else's civil rights. And as someone who identifies libertarian, I don't care what you do with your body or your stuff. So long as it doesn't hurt anybody else, you go right ahead. And that includes owning firearms and defending your own life. But you also must have in the Liberal Gun Club people that are of the more modern vernacular use of the word liberal, as well as Democrats and all of that. Does everybody get along?
You know, we have fairly heated discussions. Most people get along. We kind of, the leadership of which I'm part of kind of jokes that, you know, we're not a democracy. So, you know, we will, if somebody is being unkind, we will get rid of you. And that's one of the big reasons Liberal Gun Club exists, is that some of our membership, how it started was that as liberals, they were just getting attacked on other gun boards and they wanted a place to go talk about firearms without the ridiculousness of being called a libtard or various other much worse names. Mm-hmm. And that was why the club started. And it stayed, you know, a few hundred members for a long time. And then over the past few years, we've really been growing by leaps and bounds. And, you know, now we have, you know, several thousand paid members and about 15,000 followers on social media that interact pretty regularly. And so, you know, do 15,000 people get along all the time? No, but do we try to be a welcoming place for everybody? Yeah, we do. And that's kind of how we exist and what we exist for our members. And then we also exist to do, we do political things. We have some candidates that are endorsed now. We do training. We have a trainers program. We teach firearms instruction for people who don't necessarily want to learn from an NRA member or something like that. We have forums where people interact. We have annual meets. We have local meets. And so, you know, we're a real big functioning gun club on a national basis.
So you mentioned the local meets. Do you have, how many states do you have a strong presence in?
We have a strong presence in about 17 states. We have chapters in, oh gosh, I think we're up to 23. As of today, we might even be 25. I'm not sure. That keeps changing. If you want to have, if you want to run a chapter, we're 100% volunteer. Nobody gets paid. So it's five people who get together and sort of set up the bylaws and start their chapters and they're out there and it's great. But if there isn't a state chapter for you, there, it may either be a regional chapter. We have something called the Rocky Mountain chapter because which is a group of states, or you can be a national member. And states, you know, California does something called Meet in the Middle, which is an annual shoot at the San Luis Obispo Sportsman Association, which is an amazing, amazing gun range. People from all over the country are welcome to come to that. It's our California annual meeting, but everybody's welcome. Our annual, we have an actual annual meeting that's happening in November in Florida, and people are welcome to come to that. You know, and sometimes we just have a little, hey, I'm going to this range on this day. You guys want to come? One of our, you know, I think this is going to surprise people, but one of our biggest hotbeds of members and active chapters, our San Francisco Bay Area group gets together a lot. I mean, probably pretty close to once a month.
I would actually agree with that sentiment that there's a lot of, I would say, rabid Second Amendment supporters, not necessarily, you know, of any other political thing, but they're strong supporters of the Second Amendment in the states where so many problematic gun laws have been passed. I know I grew up in Maine, and then, but it wasn't until I moved to, and I was a supporter of the Second Amendment, but I didn't become an activist until I moved to Massachusetts and realized, oh my, our rights can be so fragile.
You know, I've never been a gun owner anywhere that I wasn't. I'm in California, and I've never been a gun owner in, you know, what's called a free state in the gun world. I've always lived with the restrictions, but, you know, I went from never having fired a gun to becoming an activist in, and, you know, a national activist in about 4 years, because it's such an issue, and it's so hard. And so I think people in these states really do fight harder, and people on, I think these are the states that are actually, you might even have a bigger liberal presence of gun owners in California than you do in, you know, say states like Montana or Arizona, where the fight's not as on the ground.
Yeah, no, I was actually super worried. I mentioned at our mutual friend Lara Carno's interview, when she was talking about the Colorado recall election, was when Michael Bloomberg moved into Maine, he put in a referendum question and threw a lot of money in Maine's relatively small state. So it didn't take all that much for him to buy up all the media time. And I was very, very concerned, because Maine is probably one of the most, it's not the, I would actually argue the most gun-friendly state in the union is New Hampshire, just south, but Maine is right next door and very, very similar with its laws, and certainly puts any of the states that are quote-unquote gun-friendly to shame, places like Texas and Florida. And I was just worried that because gun ownership is just so prevalent there, and so, matter of fact, it's not a big deal to walk into someone's house and there's a rifle hanging up in one of the rooms, or, you know, somebody might own a handgun or have a carry permit. It's just, it's not a big deal there. And I was worried that people would be complacent. And I certainly see it in other states where it does happen. Thankfully, Maine did end up pushing back that referendum and didn't get universal background checks. But again, it's, I can definitely see states that where there isn't the battle going on, you know, right at your doorstep, people not realizing that the Second Amendment is as important, as fragile as it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. And I think that's part of why Liberal Gun Club exists. It exists not only to give, you know, space and voice to non-stereotypical gun owners, but it also exists to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, you're fighting against things that your constituents disagree with. Let's talk about this. You know, especially in California, it's really frustrating here. We've lost so many rights, and California is so big and it costs so much money to run a successful statewide campaign here that it's really hard, and people toe this party line that, you know, to some extent, Bloomberg really is the one that's bought on the Democratic side. And so you have a lot of people who really don't know anything about firearms, but are vehemently anti-gun, running in these statewide elections. Yet California has more gun owners than any other state in the country, including Texas.
Oh, that's interesting. So one more thing before we go is, you were mentioning, of course, that the, many of the people for the Liberal Gun Club had come from other forums and other groups where the use of the word libtard, let's just say right now, just don't use that term when talking to somebody else, because it just shuts doors, and we need to be opening doors. If we're going to win, if we're going to achieve, we need to do it together, not separately. And I love for the fact that there's a group like the Liberal Gun Club. I love the fact that there's the Second Amendment Sisters, the Pink Pistols, all these separate groups. But I also would like to see, again, places like the Second Amendment Foundation, where we're all rubbing elbows and we all, you know, got to know each other. There's a place where we can stand and fight together. We were talking about another organization, and you had some strong feelings that they might be a little bit more divisive. Do you want to finish up on that?
Sure. We were talking about the NRA, and one of my issues with the NRA, I think they have great training. I obviously think there's things that they do well. But I think that the NRA is in many ways harmful to the rights of gun owners because they're so divisive. And it's a real problem to me to have the NRA be such a divisive organization. If you're going to be the monolith and you're going to be the voice, you have to be inclusive. And I think the NRA has lost their way on that. But I'm really happy to see organizations like the Second Amendment Foundation and others that are out there, and the Liberal Gun Club being a voice, and other groups. You know, we have to fill that void in. If that organization has lost its way, we've got to be the ones out there filling that void.
Oh, I totally agree. And I agree with you. I don't like the divisive rhetoric that's been coming out of the NRA as of late. I think it turns people away, and that's not what we need. And I think we do need a group like the NRA. It's so big that I think it would cost us more to dismantle it than it would for us to fix it. And I hope to see everybody helping with that. I mean, I'm an NRA Life member, working to make sure that we don't neglect people that are staunch fighters for the Second Amendment just because they don't fit into a certain box.
I think that's really important. And I think what one of the things Liberal Gun Club does is we try to give people an alternative place to come. If you're not comfortable with the NRA because of their divisive rhetoric or something else, I mean, there's plenty of reasons not to want to be part of the NRA. And that's okay. There's plenty of reasons not to want to be parts of lots of groups. If people want a different place to come, the Liberal Gun Club is a good place for that. You know, I can't tell you the number of times someone says to me, hey, can I have your card or your sticker or your, you know, something that says your Facebook page or your web page. I want to give it to my wife or my daughter or my son or my son-in-law. Hey, you know, I think they'd be really interested. I think they'd be willing to learn about guns, but, you know, they don't want to take an NRA class or they don't want to go to my range where, you know, my friend is going to berate them. You know, we have that group, and I think it's good to have other groups out there. I think Pink Pistols and really Operation Blazing Sword with Aaron, you know, that's another one of those groups where there's people out there. I you know, Pink Pistols has its own set of issues, but Operation Blazing Sword is 1,600 instructors who say, hey, look, we're happy to instruct, you know, members of the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. That's great. That's what we need. By the way, I'm a member of Operation Blazing Sword. I'm one of their instructors on their list. So, you know, I think it's important to be out there. Liberal Gun Club has instructors. Other organizations have instructors. And I think it's great that that's coming up now in our culture, because I think that's what we need. We can't continue to be, you know, we can't continue to circle the wagons if we want to save our rights. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Lara Smith, for talking about the Liberal Gun Club and for just being out there and fighting for inclusive support of the Second Amendment. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So thanks for the shout out, Lara. I really appreciate that. So Weird, did you know that the Liberal Gun Club has its own instructor certification?
She mentioned it like offhand. I didn't quite pick up on that, but I know that they're not necessarily going with the NRA instructor program, which is kind of the bench standard.
Yes, and that's exactly why. Because if people are not comfortable with the NRA and they join the Liberal Gun Club instead, it would make sense to have an instructor certification that isn't NRA-based. And so the LGC currently has instructors in 16 states, and I think that they're having trouble getting states to recognize their certification. But I really do hope that they expand to the other 34, because that will continue to hammer home the message that owning and using firearms is something that all Americans do, not just conservatives.
Yeah, and again, NRA is like the bench standard. Even here in Massachusetts, I have an NRA basic pistol qualification certificate, because that is the training course that is taken by people in Massachusetts when you're applying for your gun permit. And that is pretty much the course in almost every state, except for like a handful that have their own specific courses. And it's a great course. There's nothing, there's no problem with it, but it does have NRA at the top of it. And Lara pointed out some great reasons why some people might not like the NRA. And so, yeah, having something that is competing with them, it's good for everybody.
Well, really, I mean, that's capitalism, right? We don't believe in monopolies. Mm-hmm. Competition brings out the best in everyone.
Yeah, it's really better for the NRA as well for them to have competition.
All right. So speaking of competition and comparison, David used to live in New York, but now he lives in Tennessee. Gun owners in both states frequently wish for things, but depending on where they live, they have different kinds of wishes. David lists some examples of each and gets in a little bragging on the side in this episode of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. You may be familiar with the old saying, if wishes were horses, even beggars would ride. If you haven't heard that one before, I'm sure you can figure out its meaning. One of the differences I've noticed since we moved out of New York is the types of wishes I hear from people in the firearms community. Following are some specific examples of my time in New York, contrast with those from our new home. Back when we still lived in New York, I was hanging out at one of the local gun shops, and I overheard a customer talking with a clerk about ordering a Desert Eagle pistol. The clerk was trying to explain to the customer that this specific pistol was not legal in New York due to its unloaded weight being over 50 ounces. The customer was having a hard time understanding why that was an issue. The clerk finally got through to him that it didn't have to make sense, it was the law. When he finally comprehended that there was no legal way to own that pistol in New York, the customer exclaimed something along the lines of, "I wish we could repeal these stupid laws." We all agreed, while understanding sadly that that was extremely unlikely in New York. Since that incident, IMI has introduced a lightened version of the Mark 19 Desert Eagle in .357 Magnum, called the L5, that weighs in at 49.6 ounces unloaded. This puts it less than half an ounce below the arbitrary weight limit of 50 ounces and therefore makes it New York legal. Unfortunately, the lightweight version in 50 Action Express, called the L6, weighs 55 ounces unloaded and is therefore still not legal in New York. In my new home state, the biggest firearm-related grumble I hear is about the length of the licensing class when applying for their pistol license. A licensing process, by the way, that generally takes around 2 weeks from application to license in hand. I also hear people in my new state complain about how long it takes the BATFE to process the paperwork for a new suppressor, short-barreled rifle, or short-barreled shotgun. Speaking of suppressors, another new product that's caused some gnashing of teeth in New York and salivating desire most everywhere else is the Maxim 9 pistol. The Maxim 9 is an integrally suppressed 9mm pistol produced by Silencer Co. It was initially announced at the 2015 SHOT Show and reached the market in April of 2017. Almost every gun magazine has done an article on the Maxim 9 since it was first announced, and many shooters have been eagerly awaiting a chance to get their hands on one. The New York gun community lamented the fact that none would be allowed across their borders as suppressors, or silencers if you prefer, have not been legal in New York State for over half a century. At least not for the average citizen. I've seen employees of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation sighting in their silenced rifles at the range I belonged to at the time. The gun shop where I work in my new home state received some Maxim 9 pistols, including one for rent at the indoor range. Did you know that the Maxim 9 takes standard Glock magazines? As store armorer, I had to clean the rental gun and then test fire it for proper function and accuracy. It's a tough job, but I manage somehow. We've also received a few of the Auto Ordnance semi-automatic Thompson carbines at the store, including one for rental at the range. These are pretty accurate replicas of both the gangster and World War II era Tommy guns, albeit in semi-auto and with 16-inch barrels. Even though they weigh over 11 pounds, and it can be challenging to work the charging handle, we sold three of them within the first week of their arrival in the store. Due to there being a semi-automatic rifle with detachable magazine and pistol grip, these replica Tommy guns are not currently legal in New York. Any that were owned prior to the SAFE Act were required to be registered or sold out of state. There's another New York connection with the Tommy gun as well. The original Auto Ordnance Company assets were purchased by Numrick Arms Company in 1951. Based in West Hurley, New York, a small town near Kingston, Numrick is probably better known as the owner of Gun Parts Corporation. They manufactured full-auto Thompson submachine guns for a number of years before releasing a semi-auto version in the mid-70s. Carr Arms purchased the Auto Ordnance Division of Numrick in 1999 and continued Tommy gun production in West Hurley, along with manufacture of their pistol line at the main Carr facility in Pearl River, New York. Following the passage of the New York SAFE Act in 2013, Carr moved all firearm production out of New York State, primarily to Pennsylvania. With Governor Cuomo likely to win re-election for a third term, the state assembly annually passing a variety of anti-gun laws by a wide margin, and the state senate teetering on the edge of becoming majority anti-gun following this election, my contacts in the New York firearms community are expressing all sorts of wishes for the future of gun owners in New York State. Meanwhile, in my new home state, one of the challenges in primary and general elections is often choosing between multiple pro-gun candidates. This is as good a place as any to mention that the first defense against anti-gun laws is electing pro-gun candidates at every level of government. Your town supervisor or county executive may be your next state senator or attorney general. So remember, Vote early, vote often. I'm just kidding. Don't do that. It's illegal. Seriously. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Wow, tough job you have there, David.
Oh, that's rough. Oh, boy. I mean, I've had some rough jobs. I used to sell knives for Cutco. That was a kind of a tough job. I hauled hazardous waste for a little while. But, man, that, yeah, having to clean and test fire the guns, oh, that's rough.
Yeah, I really can't think of a job that's harder than being a gun store armorer. Oh, just thank you for your service, David.
All right, returning for his second week of contribution to the Assorted Calibers podcast, Oddball returns with another Blade Talk. This time, it's a subject that I have much interest in, Damascus and pattern welded steel.
In my last segment, I briefly mentioned steel laminates, Damascus steel, and pattern welding. If you've done much construction or home improvement, I'm sure you're familiar with the term laminate. If you're not, basically think of a sandwich. You have multiple layers on top of each other and bound together. It's often used with wood to make large pieces of thin, strong panels. With metals, it's typically used to take advantage of the properties of the different metals. With knives, you usually see this done with a hard steel in the middle that has good edge retention, wear resistance, etc., but isn't that great when it comes to corrosion resistance. Take that steel and sandwich it between two layers of a softer steel that won't hold a good edge, but has high corrosion resistance. This specific type of laminate is often referred to by the Japanese term sanmai. A couple good examples of this are some of the carbon steel Mora knives, where they use a hard carbon steel core sandwiched between layers of softer stainless steel. And Spyderco has made a couple folding knives with a HAP-40 core sandwiched between SUS-410. HAP-40 is a very hard steel that has excellent edge retention, but it will not only corrode very quickly, it's honestly getting a little bit too hard for me. SUS-410, on the other hand, is an incredibly soft steel that is very corrosion resistant, but no one even tries to make a blade out of it. In the case of the Spyderco knives, this also adds the cool feature that, as time goes on and the HAP-40 discolors, you can see where the outer layer ends and the core begins. This resembles the wavy pattern, or hamon, on the blade of a katana, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Now, Damascus is a bit more complicated version of laminated steel. If you take that sanmai and twist it, fold it over, bend it, and then beat it back into a bar before forming it into your blade, you've basically got Damascus steel. Obviously, this technique often uses more than three layers, and a knife maker may stack many layers of Damascus together to get the desired effect for the size of the blade they're making. It's fairly standard for the knife maker to dip the blade in an acid bath to emphasize the different layers of steel. Remember that different steels will discolor at different rates. A skilled metalsmith can make a variety of different patterns using this technique, ranging from random chaos to a very clear and crisp pattern. The difficult part with Damascus steel is figuring out just how good it's going to be. Remember that the pattern goes all the way through the blade, so all of the metals will get hit by the elements, and all the metals will also show up along the edge of the blade. This means all the steels used need to be at least decent at both tasks. Some knife makers will come out and tell you what the different steels are, and some won't. In general, I tend to follow my advice on generic stainless steels. If they won't tell me, it's because it's not good. Please do take note that you might run into folks using things like Damasteel, which is a trademarked Damascus that's really quite good. I have a couple knives that are made of Damascus steel, and they are quite pretty and functional, both using a mixture of 1095 and 15N20 steels, which are both pretty good for knife making. That said, frankly, today's metallurgy can produce a uniform steel that will perform just as well, if not better, than Damascus for less. if for no other reason than due to the consistency of the metal. You should really look at Damascus steel knives as functional showpieces for when you want to dress up, rather than a daily beater. Oh, and before I get the angry comments, yes, I know what I'm talking about isn't true and proper Damascus, and is really pattern welding. Quote, real Damascus was made by a process of forging Wootz steel, which had a similar pattern due to the inconsistencies of the metal inherent in the manufacturing techniques. The problem is that no one is really quite sure how it was made. That knowledge was lost sometime in the 17th century. If you really want to get geeky, it's an interesting topic, but really outside the scope of this segment. That said, the industry has embraced the use of the term for pattern welding, and it's now standard to call all pattern welding Damascus. I mentioned that I'd talk a bit about katanas and their hamon earlier. While katanas are traditionally made with laminate steel, the hamon is not created by the different steels. The steel in a katana was traditionally folded somewhere between 8 and 16 times. This would give you somewhere between 256 and over 65,000 layers, which, well, means at that point the layers are really too thin to see, even after going through an acid bath. The hamon is a wavy line that's actually created by differential heat treatment. The sword maker would pack clay around the spine of the blade during the heat treating process. This would cause it to cool slower than the edge, and therefore not get as hard. This is how sword makers were able to make a large blade that could retain a good edge and still be flexible enough to withstand hard impacts. A side product of this is that you can often see a line where the hard and soft steels meet. This really isn't used for knife making, since knives are generally too short to require it, but I thought it was interesting, so I threw it in. Anyways, if you have any questions, please feel free to email me at oddball@gunscarstech.com or give me a shout on the ACP Facebook group. Until next time, have a good one.
But what if someone wants to make a katana out of Damascus steel?
I think you could do it, because it's just gotta do the hamon, and but you get the spine metal. Yeah, no, it could be done. It could be done. I'll just say that.
Oh, I figure it can. I just wanted to make people's brains explode if possible.
Yeah. No, I love Damascus. Like, that's my bucket list, is I want to have a presentation piece level 1911 with a Damascus steel slide. There's a company, it's a bunch of people. Caspian's the number one vendor of them, but essentially everybody that's got a Damascus steel slide, it's made by the same company. There's one group that produces Damascus billets that are suitable for making pistol slides, and they are absolutely gorgeous, and I want one so bad.
Every time gun control is brought up, the statistic of suicide is always invoked. And the idea is always that if we can prevent suicidal people from getting access to guns, they won't commit suicide. In this week's Audio Fisk, Weird addresses a very sensitive topic, the topic of gun control and suicide.
With many of these Weird Audio Fisks, I tackle them with relish. I get excited when I hear the lies, and I know I can rebut them. And then I feel even better when I do my preparation and research and deliver that rebuttal for all of you to hear. And hopefully, one day, you get to repeat or reference them when you find yourself in a conversation with people who are agreeable to the anti-gun agenda. This Fisk isn't one of them. It's an issue I tend to avoid. And while I could choose to tackle another piece of anti-gun propaganda, I feel that any lie or twist of facts that we let go unchallenged will grow in power. The topic I'm going to be discussing is suicide. This is a very serious subject. And if you or somebody you know is contemplating suicide, get help now. There are resources for you, like the Suicide Prevention Lifeline or Samaritan Suicide Prevention. You can call 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255 or 877-870-HOPE. That's 877-870-4673. And talk to somebody who can help right now. And before we go on, I'll say I have lost loved ones to suicide and have had loved ones attempt suicide. It's very painful and a subject I do not take lightly. So why am I discussing suicide on a Second Amendment podcast? Because in America, about 50% of the suicides in this country are by firearm. And because our opponents are ghoulish, they have no issues with warping this painful and horrible thing into their anti-gun agenda. So on to this video by Everytown, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg Incorporated, on suicide.
She'd been hospitalized 4 times the last year of her life for mental illness and severe depression. But after all that, because it had been a voluntary commitment, nothing went on record.
This is because of HIPAA, or Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and the Gun Control Act of 1968. See, the GCA stated that your rights could only be removed by a judge and full due process of the law. And HIPAA makes sure that your medical records are kept private. Anti-gunners want to make voluntary hospitalization something that will turn you into a prohibited person. Except if it's voluntary treatment, do you think this will encourage or discourage more people to get help?
If she had been ordered to go into treatment by a judge, she wouldn't have been able to pass a background check.
This is true. Also note that when a person suffering from mental illness goes before a judge, it's often due to this person having interactions with law enforcement or otherwise committing a crime due to the nature of their illness. I can't speak for this woman's late daughter, but I will say just because someone has an issue with mental health does not automatically make them a danger to themselves or others. And seeking help for a mental issue is no different than seeking help for any other medical problem. For the antis, it's more important that we ban guns than people get the help that they need.
I think the impulse to kill yourself is often short-lived, and if you can just get past it, you'll find a way to live.
For some, this is true. For others, it absolutely isn't.
You always hear, oh, they'll just find another way to die, but that's not true. Most people that survive an attempt do not go on to die by suicide.
Tell that to my friend who, after multiple attempts, eventually ended her own life. I understand that there have been studies that show many who attempted suicide and fail often never try again. Still, that is very glib in the light of people who are indeed determined to end their own life. And even more tone deaf when it's paired with a gun control message, as half of the suicides in this country are done without a firearm. Bloomberg is willing to throw a lot of suffering people under the bus just to forward his agenda.
Based on my experience, I didn't have a firearm. If there was ever at that moment that I wanted to, you know, it'd probably be for suicide.
So here's something interesting. If you go to the show notes, you'll notice that this gentleman is not anywhere in the Everytown video. See, I collected the audio for this over a year ago for my segment on the Gunblog Variety Cast. And as you might have guessed, I avoided it as best I could because these videos really upset me. But then in June 2018, this video showed up again. It seemed unchanged. The length of the videos were nearly identical. Except this gentleman was replaced by another man. I wish I had saved the original video rather than just the audio. But going from my memory, this man was somebody who had been adjudicated mentally ill and had attempted suicide in the past. He was placed in the video to show why it's good to be a prohibited person. So why is he gone now? I can't know for sure, as I can't find the original video. Everytown has scrubbed it from the internet. If I had to guess, I'm betting he committed suicide.
The medication that Angela was on to save her life was more difficult to get and was more regulated than the gun and the bullets that she bought to end her life.
Now, this is just crap. First up, it's hard to compare the two, as they're both heavily regulated, but regulated differently. In some ways, it's harder to get medication than a gun. As in most states, you can just walk into a gun store, pass a background check, and walk out. For a prescription, you need to see a doctor. But my wife has some of her medication mailed to our house. I have guns mailed to my house too, but that's because I hold a federal firearms license. I also pick up my wife's prescription from the pharmacy. No ID, no background checks. So it isn't that one is more or less regulated. They're just different.
When someone is in a state of despair and hopelessness, maybe they're a young person, maybe they're impulsive. If they have a gun in their hand, they're probably going to die. If they use another means to try to end their life and harm themselves, they probably will survive.
This is Dr. Jeffrey Swanson, a professor from Duke University. And if you do a little bit of Googling of his name or look him up on Twitter, he's a fan of every form of gun control out there. This is probably one of the most glib and callous statements made in a very glib and callous video. First, he implies that everyone in despair is suicidal. Of course that isn't true. Second, he brings up one of the talking points that is used for trying to shoehorn suicide into the gun control agenda, claiming that guns are more effective means of suicide. So by banning guns, you can prevent and lower suicide. Well, we have data for that. I think we all know that the United States is unique in the world stage with our Second Amendment and our allowance of people to own guns. At its crux, that's how we get to this ghoulish video. If people simply aren't allowed to own guns, or guns are very difficult to acquire, then suicide by guns is going to be relatively rare. But look at the show notes. I have a list of all the world nations by suicide rate. While we have lots of guns here, and therefore a lot of gun suicides, the number of people who actually take their own lives in this country isn't particularly high or low. Even when you look from state to state, you'll find that laws can change how suicide happens, but doesn't change that it does happen. Here in Massachusetts, hanging and suffocation is one of the most common methods of suicide, and firearm suicide is relatively uncommon.
If you have epilepsy and you have a seizure, nobody knows it, but your driver's license is revoked until you're seizure-free X amount of time. Then your doctor contacts the DMV and your license is reinstated.
Now, the laws differ from state to state, but my wife has epilepsy and was uncontrolled for a number of years. And in the state of Massachusetts, she had a valid driver's license. She could legally drive, but in the event of an accident, even if her epilepsy wasn't a factor, her medical history would be introduced as part of the case. Some states do revoke licenses, but either way, depending on your state law, once you have no seizures for 6 months to a year, you can again resume driving. Compare that with the anti-gun agenda. Have you ever seen a gun violence prevention group push for restoring of rights? Of course not. They just want to remove more and more people from the ranks of lawful gun owners until only their personal security teams remain.
If your doctor feels you're a danger to yourself, they contact the police. So why can't that contact, without anybody else knowing, go into a system where you cannot go pick up a gun?
Remember that Jeffrey Swanson guy who's being cited as an expert on the issue? When questioned on violent behavior in the wake of mass shootings, he was quoted as saying, "Can we reliably predict violence? No, is the short answer. Psychiatrists using clinical judgment are not much better than chance at predicting which individual patients will do something violent and which will not." The scope of that statement is that we just can't lock up people who have a certain clinical diagnosis, because they really can't determine if a person's going to become violent with any reasonable accuracy. Same goes for suicide. Sure, some illnesses and medication combinations have been shown to elevate the risk of suicide, but that doesn't mean it's a predictor. Meanwhile, these people aren't dangerous, and they still live in a world where they might need a gun for self-protection.
If we're going to have a culture of guns, we need to have a culture of gun safety, and that includes sensible laws. Do you think people wear their seatbelt because it's the law? You don't even think about it. You get in your car, you'd feel kind of naked without a seatbelt. It's a habit. The culture has changed, but the law helped to change those norms.
Well, except I live in New England. In Massachusetts, motorcycle helmets are mandatory. New Hampshire and Maine, they aren't. Occasionally you see people without helmets on their bikes, but generally not. Also, it goes without saying that this is Michael Bloomberg here. The culture he wants to change is the culture of owning guns.
If someone is suffering, we should ask if there's a gun. I just want people to be able to ask those questions, because if they do leave the earth, it's too late. And you're not going to regret asking the question if you save their life.
This is a good clip to end on. Really, we don't need laws, because laws by their nature are blanket and unthinking. We all have people in our lives who go through tough times, and we know when they're hurting, and we know when they're doing okay. There is nothing wrong with asking about how somebody is doing and if they have guns. And if you really think they're a danger, it isn't unreasonable to ask if it might be a good idea for those guns to live in your safe until things are a little better. That is, unless you live in a state where Michael Bloomberg got his way with universal background checks. Then taking guns for safekeeping is now a felony. But they care so much about suicides. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
It's a very serious subject, and I was trying really hard not to make my introduction sound like this week on a very special episode of Weird Audio Fisk. Because my tendency, I've got a strange sense of humor, and I don't want to make light of really serious subjects. But there are some times when things are just so awful, I feel like we have to laugh at them in order to keep our sanity. And so that's where my brain was going. And it was like, no, do this straight. Don't make it sound like it's a public service announcement.
And I'm kind of coming at it from the other angle, is that I tend to be pretty jovial about just bashing on the anti-gun points and calling BS and just being rough on them. But I really have a hard time, especially with some of the people speaking BS. They aren't paid lobbyists. These are people that are just being courted by the paid lobbyists to talk about loved ones who they've lost. And I can point out the fact that they said wrong things, but I can't attack them directly. I can't blame them for even going in that direction, but it's not the right solution. And again, this was audio that I collected for the Gunblog Variety Cast, which is no more, and brought it back only really because they had that revision for reasons I can't exactly explain, but I deeply suspect. It's a tough one for me to tackle, but at the same time, it needs to be tackled because we can't cede any ground to them, because that's why they're going after suicide. That's why they're belittling all the people who have lost loved ones to suicide, not by guns. Or to throw people under the bus because they may have depression or other mental illnesses, and saying, oh yeah, you're just going to harm yourself. That's all you do. It's so ghoulish what they're doing, and we really need to call them out on it.
In related news, this happened while I was out of town, but I discovered upon returning that Doug Crick, a.k.a. Cricket, the founder of Pink Pistols, actually died last week. He took his own life. I don't know the details. He was a gun owner? I don't know. I don't want to speculate. All I know is that this person who was fundamental to the creation of Pink Pistols unfortunately lost his battle with depression last week and took his own life. And so just anyone who has had their life improved by Pink Pistols, just spare a thought for his family and perhaps post some condolences, some well wishes on his Facebook page.
Oh, yeah, it's such a tough way to lose somebody that way. And I'm so sorry for your loss. And I'm just so sorry for the world and the nation's loss at that.
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the new ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump not featuring Aaron this month. You can get more from me at my nerd blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com, my emergency preparedness blog, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com, and of course, my two charities, pinkpistols.org and blazingsword.org.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network. And thank you to Nate Spencer for our wonderful music.
He doesn't know what day of the week it is, and my farts smell like vanilla. I don't really know where I'm going with this, but our thoughts are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.